New York City is famous for its ticker tape parades. Over 200 parades have been given in honor of single individuals. The most attended ticker tape parade ever was the one given in 1980 to welcome home the American hostages from Iran. In 1930, when golfer Bobby Jones returned to America from winning his second British Open, the city gave Jones his second ticker tape parade. He was chauffeured down Broadway Street from Battery Park to City Hall under a rainfall of paper and confetti. Afterwards, the gracious Bobby Jones, he recalled the parade. He said it was the most triumphant journey any man ever traveled in sports. It was so overwhelming, apparently, that Jones retired from his sport shortly thereafter. But if New York City gave a ticker tape parade to welcome home a golfer, you would think that the city of Nazareth would have done something similar for the Son of God. By the time we get to Mark chapter 6, Jesus has been out and about. He's built quite a reputation. He's healed the sick and cast out demons and even raised the dead. Huge crowds have followed Jesus everywhere he's gone. He is the man in demand there in Galilee. You'd think that the people of Nazareth would be thrilled that their hometown hero was paying them a visit, that they'd take pride in a homeboy who'd become famous. You would think that ticker tape would pour in rain in downtown Nazareth. But when Jesus makes his home run, the town has an unexpected reaction. Verse 1 tells us, "Then he went out from there and came to his own country, and his disciples followed him." Now, it was a 22-mile walk from Capernaum to Nazareth. But I have discovered that it's always downhill when you're headed home. I'm sure Jesus looked forward to going home, to hanging out with his brothers, to seeing his mom, to visiting his friends. I'd go as far as to say that for Jesus, this was probably a mini vacation. His life in recent days had been a whirlwind of activity and constant demands. It could be that Jesus saw his trip home as an eye in the storm, an eye in the middle of the hurricane, a port of call in a troubled storm. And when the Sabbath had come, we're told, he began to teach in the synagogue. And many hearing him were astonished, saying, "Where did this man get these things? And what wisdom is this which is given to him, that such mighty works are performed by his hands? Is this not the carpenter?" Tekton is the Greek word that's translated carpenter. And from tekton, we get our word technical. A tekton was a technical carpenter. Rather than just a construction worker who framed houses and used roughed out timber, the tekton made furniture and tools. He was a detailed craftsman. There is a legend that says that Jesus' specialty while a carpenter was wooden yokes. A wooden harness, you know, had to be an exact fit. If not, it would rub or irritate the animal. And the legend goes that there was a sign hanging over Joseph and Jesus' carpenter shop that said, "The best fitting yokes made here." The yokes that Jesus crafted were always perfect fits. And guess what? They still are. Hey, when Jesus asks you to climb into his harness and to submit your life to him and to follow him and to be yoked with him, he always says, "My yoke is easy and my burden is light." Guys, the calling of Jesus is always a perfect fit. He equips you to do what he calls you to do. Along with the task comes a love for that task. If today you're under a heavy burden, guess what? It didn't come from Jesus. His burden is always light. His yoke is always easy. You've probably heard of the four spiritual laws. It's a popular witnessing tool that begins, "God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life." But I've heard a modification. "God loves you and people have a wonderful plan for your life." Other people, even the church, can lay heavy burdens on us. Jesus wants our serving him to be a delight, not a duty, a joy, not just a job. But they not only called Jesus carpenter, They called him the son of Mary. And this was an insult, mind you, not a compliment. In ancient Israel, men were referred to by the name of the patriarch, even if the father was now deceased. By calling Jesus the son of Mary, they were actually questioning his parentage. You see, the town folks remembered the scandal surrounding Jesus' birth. Mary had turned up pregnant before her marriage to Joseph, and very few of the people believed her explanation that it was a miracle. By calling Jesus the son of Mary, the Nazarenes were saying, we don't really know who his father was. They called him the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us? You know, the Roman Catholics teach that Mary remained a virgin all her life. They call it Mary's perpetual virginity. I think perpetual fertility is more like it. She had at least 6 more kids. But here is the point. Rather than throw Jesus a ticker tape parade or roll out the red carpet or give him the keys to the city, we're told in verse 3, and they were offended at him. They thought his claim to be anything more than a neighborhood homeboy was scandalous. They rejected him as the Messiah. You see, here was the problem. The men of Nazareth were too proud to acknowledge that one of their own could be more than just a peer. Hey, we played in the sandbox with Jesus. You remember him? He was on Larry's Little League team. Oh, yeah, he was a freshman when I was a senior. You've all heard the expression, familiarity can breed contempt. Well, it's true. The more familiar you are with a person, the more likely you are to take him or her for granted. And this is what Jesus says in verse 4. But Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his own country, among his own relatives, and in his own house. What a disappointment for Jesus. He had come home looking forward to friends and family and some R&R, but instead of a vacation, he got a rejection. Maybe you've had a similar experience. Coming to Jesus, since you've been getting serious about following Jesus, your commitment to the Lord has put some distance now between you and your family, you and your old homeboys. The last time you went home, it was obvious. It just wasn't the same. Now that you're a Christian, they treat you differently. Hey, at least you can say you're in good company. For if this is how his family treated Jesus, you can expect it to happen to you as well. A prophet is not without honor except in his own country. That's why you're going to have to re-win their respect in a different way. Verse 5 is one of the saddest verses in all the Bible. Now he could not do mighty works there except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. This was Jesus' hometown. If he worked a miracle anywhere, he wanted it to be here. He desired to bless his family and friends, but he was limited by their unbelief. Reminds me of Psalm 78, verse 41. We're told that the unbelief of the Hebrews, the children of Israel, limited the Holy One of Israel. Here it happens again. God always performs miracles in response to faith. And where faith is lacking, the spirit gets quenched. Lois Chaney has a poem. She writes, there was a place where the unbelief was so great that Jesus, the Son of God, could not heal and help, and so he left them. And then she asks, has anyone seen Jesus lately? Has anyone seen Jesus in your life? In your family? In your ministry? Hey, God never goes into hibernation. He wants to do wonderful works in our lives, but the prerequisite is always faith. We're told in verse 6, and he marveled because of their unbelief. 2 times in Scripture we're told that Jesus marveled. Here he marvels over the unbelief of the Jews. In Luke chapter 7, he marveled over the faith of a Roman centurion, a Gentile. A Gentile who believed that Jesus could heal his servant by just saying a word. You know, we are all a marvel to Jesus. He is either amazed by our faith or our lack of it. Then he went about the villages in a circuit teaching. And he called the 12 to himself and began to send them out two by two and gave them power over unclean spirits. Notice the disciples went out two by two. It just goes to prove good fruit always comes in pairs. Good fruit always comes in pairs. I know that's kind of rotten, I know. Hey, there's Batman and Robin, Superman and Superboy, Barney and Andy. God uses dynamic duos. When you go to serve the Lord, why don't you take a friend? One of you can pray while the other one talks. You can watch each other's back. There's always safety going two by two. Verse 8 tells us, Jesus commanded them to take nothing for the journey except a staff. And Jesus is not talking here about your administrator and your CPA and your lawyer and your publicity agent and your makeup artist and all your bodyguards. It's amazing what some preachers need these days to do ministry. They need a whole entourage. The staff Jesus is talking about here is a stick, not a pastoral posse. Also, no bag, he says. Don't worry about a bag. Literally, it's a beggar's bag. Don't beg for funds, he says. Hey, we need to be assured God's work done God's way will never lack God's support. You won't have to beg for the work of God. He'll fund his own work. Where God guides, he provides. He says no bread, no copper in their money belts, but to wear sandals and not to put on two tunics. In other words, travel light and live by faith. Have a simple approach to ministry. Don't carry around a lot of baggage when you try to serve the Lord. Verse 10 says, also he said to them, in whatever place you enter a house, stay there till you depart from that place. I love Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of Jesus. He quotes him as saying, don't think you need a lot of extra equipment for this. You are the equipment. No special appeals for funds. Keep it simple. And no luxury inns. Get a modest place and be content there until you leave. When it comes to ministry, kiss it. Keep it simple, saint. Let's take a simple approach to ministry. And whoever will not receive you nor hear you when you depart from there, shake off the dust under your feet as a testimony against them. In other words, forget it and move on. If you're rejected and trying to serve the Lord, don't stand around steaming while there's still souls that need saving. I know guys who've let the resentment toward a few stifle a ministry to many. They can't get past the few people that have rejected them to minister to the many who want to receive them. Don't get bogged down in bitterness. Wipe the dust off your souls. Wipe it off your soul, too. So they went out, or surely I say to you, Jesus said, it will be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. Hey, when you're resisted, when you're rejected, let the Lord deal with the judgment. You just move on. Do what he's called you to do. And so they went out and preached that people should repent, and they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many who were sick and healed them. Now, King Herod heard of Jesus, for his name had become well known. This Herod was Herod Antipas, son of Herod the Great, the man who slaughtered the babies at Bethlehem. And this son was as bloodthirsty and as cruel as his old man. He said, John the Baptist is risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him. Others said it is Elijah, and others said it is the prophet, or like one of the prophets. But when Herod heard, he said, this is John, whom I beheaded. He has been raised from the dead. Remember, Jesus and John were cousins. And tradition says that they had a striking resemblance in appearance. Herod thought that Jesus was John. Come back to get him. It's interesting, Herod had it all. He had wealth, he had power, he had luxury, had leisure, had servants. But he was a tormented man. He was tortured by a guilty conscience. You know, it doesn't matter what you have. It doesn't matter what blessings you have or material things you have. You can't enjoy them if you've got a guilty conscience. A guilty conscience has been defined as the part of you that hurts when everything else feels good. A condemned conscience prohibited this man from enjoying his riches. It's also said that a bad conscience has a good memory. And this was the case with Herod. He was afraid that John had been resurrected from the dead and was going to take vengeance on what he had done to him. And the next few verses record his crime. For Herod himself had sent and laid hold of John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. For John had said to Herod, "It is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife." Herod Antipas, you see, was a seedy fellow, an immoral fellow. On a visit to Rome, he fell in love with his half-brother's wife, Herodias. He divorced his wife, and then he stole her from his brother. And Herodias was not only his sister-in-law, she was also his niece. And so when you add it all up, this king was guilty of divorce, adultery, and incest. Herod had turned the government of Israel into a soap opera. But John here calls him on the carpet. I love John. John was fearless. John was intimidated by no one. John takes on the ruthless king and he says, "It is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife." Verse 19 says, "Therefore Herodias held it against him and wanted to kill him, but she could not, for Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man, and he protected him. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly." You know, it's interesting that in his own warped way, Herod really respected John. Herod, you see, was a politician who based his every decision on the latest Gallup poll. In contrast, he admired John for his integrity and his courage and his purity. John's life of commitment was the opposite of Herod's life of compromise and convenience. Herodias, though, she had no respect for John at all. She hated him with a vengeance. She was a wicked and wily an image-conscious queen who didn't like to be rebuked, especially in public and especially by some backwoods preacher from the desert. Verse 21 says, "Then an opportune day came when Herod, on his birthday, gave a feast for his nobles, the high officers, and the chief men of Galilee." Did you know that there are only two birthdays mentioned in the Bible? One is in Genesis, where it talks about Pharaoh's birthday and how that on that day, the chief baker was beheaded. The other is Herod's birthday here. And once again, as we'll see, heads are going to roll. Let me suggest the next time you have a birthday, be a little careful, would you? Certainly, make sure you keep your head about you that day, would you? I hope you never have a birthday party like Herod's. It was a drunken orgy. It was a stag party. Herod's palace was turned into a Las Vegas casino. In fact, I think there's a casino out there in Las Vegas called Herod's. There's probably a connection there. I'm not sure. But verse 22 says, "And when Herodias, his daughter, herself came in and danced." And understand, this is not a square dance she's doing here, or the foxtrot. This is a striptease. The girl's name is Salome. She was young and sexy and beautiful. And apparently she'd taken some belly dancing lessons. Usually these seductive dances were performed by prostitutes. It was rare for a woman of social standing to dance in this way, especially in public. And her dance, we're told, pleased Herod and those who sat with him. The king said to the girl, "Ask me whatever you want and I will give it to you." He also swore to her, "Whatever you ask me, I will give you up to half of my kingdom." He gets a little booze under his belt and he starts making all these rash promises. And so she went out and said to her mother, "What shall I ask?" And she said, "The head of John the Baptist." And immediately she came in with haste to the king and asked, saying, "I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter." Verse 26 says, "And the king was exceedingly sorry, yet because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him, he did not want to refuse her." Now I want you to notice, Herod here had an out if he had wanted it. if he had possessed any wisdom at all. For he promised this girl anything up to half his kingdom. Hey, Herod could have told her that he considered John to be worth more than half his kingdom. He certainly was. But what happens is that lust and pride warp our value system. You end up throwing away what's rich and what's full and what's lasting and what's precious for a few passing sips of what's cheap and dull and empty. Let me warn you guys, it's a terrible trade-off. Beware of lust. Beware of pride. Immediately, the king sent an executioner and commanded his head to be brought. And he went and beheaded him in prison, brought his head on a platter, and gave it to the girl, and the girl gave it to her mother. What a way to get ahead. Hey, John lost his head so that Herod could save face. It was all about pride. That's what's going on here. He didn't want to break a promise and look bad in the eyes of the nobles at the party. Herod should have buried his pride, but instead he ended up burying John. Here's what happens. John kept his conscience and lost his head, while Herod lost his conscience to get ahead. Trust me, similar choices are made every day in our lives. At work, at school. What's more important? Doing what's right, keeping a good conscience, or looking bad in the eyes of your peers? This was the choice here that Herod made. Rather than integrity, he chose popularity. Don't make that same choice. When his disciples heard of it, they came and they took away John's corpse and laid it in a tomb. The flashback is now over. We now know why Herod was so afraid of Jesus. Mark, though, returns to the disciples who've gone out two by two. They've just come back. And in verse 30, we're told, then the apostles gathered to Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. And he said to them, come aside by yourselves to a deserted place and rest a while. For there were many coming and going, and they did not even have time to eat. Guys, it is so true. If we don't learn to come apart, we'll come apart. The stress and strain of life pulls at the seams of our lives, and eventually we tear, we'll break. Hey, we'll crack up if we don't learn to rest and relax and renew. Here's a great quote. The bow that's always bent ceases to shoot straight. That's why you've got to relax the string from time to time. Jesus knew this was true of his disciples then and of us today. The disciples had been busy with ministry, hustling and bustling, serving the Lord. But Jesus knew the importance of taking time to get away and to get alone with the Lord. Hey, we all need to take time to spend with God. Time to rejuvenate our juices, you might say. Always remember, a revived, refreshed person can accomplish far more for God than a perpetually pushed person. What kind of person are you? Verse 32 tells us, so they departed to a deserted place in the boat by themselves, but the multitude saw them departing, and many knew him and ran there on foot from all the cities. They arrived before them and came together to him. And Jesus, when he came out, saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion for them because they were like sheep not having a shepherd. Now I can hear the disciples, they're saying to each other, oh no. Here come all those people again, man. Won't those people leave us alone just for long enough to eat? But that wasn't Jesus' attitude at all. He was moved with compassion, we're told. He saw the people not as a nuisance or a bother or even obligation, but as lost sheep. And he wanted to be their shepherd. He still feels that way about people. And so he began to teach them many things. And when the day was now far spent, his disciples came to him and said, this is the deserted place, and already the hour is late. Send them away that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat. Now, in the springtime in Galilee, the sun sets around 6 p.m. It was probably around 5 at the time, and the disciples knew that the people were getting hungry. Their stomachs were growling themselves. And they had a hungry crowd on their hands. Verse 44 tells us that there were 5,000 men. And when you add kids and women, that could have easily been 15,000 people. And here's the kicker. There's not a Waffle House in sight. But he answered and said to them, "You give them something to eat." Now, I think there are times when Jesus lets us try to do it ourselves. It's in those moments we learn just how helpless we are. Just how much we need Him. And I picture these guys, you know, getting out their calculator or maybe their abacus. And they're doing the math, man. And they're scratching their heads and they're multiplying, you know, the amount of Whoppers needed by number of mouths there to feed. And they're scratching their heads and they're rubbing their chin and they're thinking to themselves, there's just no way. And they say to him, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give them something to eat?" This was a bit of sarcasm. The disciples knew that there was nowhere that they could go to purchase that amount of bread. But note, Jesus doesn't do the miracle until they first are thoroughly baffled. And I think He does the same with us. Jesus waits until we realize that the solution to our situation can't be calculated. We can't plot it out. We don't know. It's beyond us. And when the disciples give up trying to do the math, that's when Jesus does some miracle math. He said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And when they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then He commanded them to make them all sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in ranks, in hundreds and in fifties. Notice Jesus tells His disciples to get organized. Go out and arrange the groups in fifties and hundreds. It's going to make the distribution easier later. You know, I found some super spiritual folks. They think that any effort on our part to organize is quenching the work of the Holy Spirit. Well, it didn't this day. As a matter of fact, here we see the ideal. Spirit-led organization and a Spirit-filled miracle work hand in hand. God is not against organization. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 40 tells us, "Let all things be done decently and in order." And that's what Jesus does here. Verse 41, "And when He had taken the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, He looked up to heaven, blessed and broke the loaves, and gave them to His disciples to set before them. And the 2 fish He divided among them all. So they all ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of fragments and of the fish. Now those who had eaten the loaves were about 5,000 men. This was a miracle of multiplication. Jesus manipulates the molecular structure of the fish in the loaves, and He transforms it into enough to feed 5,000 people. Actually, 5,000 families. We don't know how many people. And notice there were still 12 baskets of leftovers. And you wonder why 12. That seems deliberate, doesn't it? I just think that Jesus wanted there to be one basket of leftovers for each of the 12 disciples. He wanted to show them that He is able to meet our needs in abundance. But here's another lesson we glean from this story. If you give Jesus the little bit that you've got, hey, your talent, your ability, it may be the equivalent of 5 loaves and 2 fish, but if you give your little bit to Jesus, He can use it in mighty ways. Maybe you feel that your life is puny. Maybe you feel powerless this morning. You're the spiritual equivalent of a brown bag lunch. Just a couple of slices of loaf bread and a pair of sardines. But you know what? Jesus wants to do a lot with your little. If you'll just let Him. And here's the key. Notice, before Jesus multiplies the fish and chips, notice what He does with them. And this is what He does with us. He blesses it. Then He breaks it. And then He gives it. You know, when you come to Jesus, He blesses you abundantly. He gives you all spiritual blessings in heavenly places. And He wants to give you out in service to the hungry people around you. But before you are given, you first have to be broken. If not, people will choke on your pride. We can cause some serious cases of spiritual indigestion. Hungry people will break their teeth on our hardness and spit us out. This is why we have to be broken of our selfishness and of our pride and of our independence. And Jesus has His ways to break us. He uses people and situations. He uses that obstinate boss or that stubborn co-worker or that lazy husband of yours or that needling wife of yours or that financial crisis that you're in or that bothersome neighbor. Jesus uses these things to break us and humble us and make us dependent upon Him. Oswald Chambers writes, God can never make us whine if we object to the fingers He uses to crush us. If God would only use His own fingers and make us broken bread and poured out wine in a special way. But when He uses someone whom we dislike or some set of circumstances to which we said we would never submit and makes those the crushers, we object. We must never choose the scene of our own martyrdom. Brokenness is never pleasant, but it is oh so necessary. Jesus blesses the bread and fish. Then He breaks it, and then He gives it. Verse 45. Immediately He made His disciples get into the boat and go before Him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while He sent the multitude away. And when He had sent them away, He departed to the mountain to pray. Now when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and He was alone on the land. And then He saw them straining at rowing, for the wind was against them. Now Jesus is on the land, but He still sees the strain on His disciples' faces. And I want you to know this morning, He sees the strain that you're under. Jesus knows the storm that surrounds you. He has not gone to sleep. Sometimes we think He has because we can't see Him. But the book of Hebrews tells us where Jesus is. He is on the mountaintop in heaven. And guess what He is doing? He is praying and interceding for you and me. And He will come to us at just the right time. And the right time for them was about the fourth watch of the night. That's when He came to them. Notice Jesus waits until the darkest hour of the night. The fourth watch began around 3 a.m. And Jesus came to them when they were utterly exhausted, when the sky was pitch black, after they had been rowing for probably 8 hours. This is what Jesus does to us. He comes to us when we're baffled, as in the previous story, but He also comes to us when we're burned out. He lets the storm beat on us until it's taken out of us all our genius and our initiative and our self-sufficiency. Jesus waits to appear until we're mentally befuddled and physically depleted. That's when Jesus came to them, walking on the sea, and He would have passed them by. They weren't expecting Him. His appearance was a complete surprise. In one moment, Jesus was nowhere to be found. In the next moment, just like that, Jesus was now here. Isn't it interesting how quickly nowhere can become now here? Just with a little space, everything can change. Remember that the next time you're in a storm. And when they saw Him walking on the sea, they supposed it was a ghost. And they cried out, for they all saw Him and were troubled. But immediately He talked with them and said to them, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid." Then He went up into the boat to them, and the wind ceased. And they were greatly amazed in themselves beyond measure and marveled. Notice Jesus calmed the storm inside the boat before He calmed the storm at sea. And this is what He wants to do in our lives. He wants us to receive victory in the midst of the storm before He gains victory over the storm. He puts us in the storm to strengthen our faith, to deepen our walk with Him. And He wants us to trust Him and learn to trust Him, even in the storms of life. And notice the reason for this episode, verse 52. for they had not understood about the loaves because their heart was hardened. Now notice, in both situations, Jesus is trying to teach them to trust him. But because they didn't learn it the first time, he gives them a retake test. Hey, if you don't like the test, why don't you just learn it the first time? When they had crossed over, they came to the land of Gennesaret and anchored there. And when they came out of the boat, immediately the people recognized him, ran through that whole surrounding region, and began to carry about on beds those who were sick to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he entered into villages, cities, or the country, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and begged him that they might just touch the hem of his garment. And I love this last line. And as many as touched him were made well. The only ticker tape parade Jesus experienced was a parade of needy people. The only confetti that fell on him were the desperate needs of people. But you see, that's why he came. He came to serve, not be served. And Jesus comes to us today to help us and to heal us and to forgive us. He wants to do so much in our lives. The only prerequisite is faith. And that's why I want to encourage you this morning. Why don't you muster up a fistful of faith this morning and reach up and touch the hem of Jesus' garment.